Welcome again to another episode of the Seven Slot Society podcast. My guest today, I think you're going to really, really enjoy. Just want to take this time before we start to go ahead and shout out some of the podcasts that I enjoy listening to that I think you should listen to as well. The first one is going to be The Talent Tank, Wyatt Pemberton. He covers Ultra 4 and racing stuff. I really enjoy that one. Mike and Max's Off-Road podcast, some guys out of Arizona. Really enjoy listening to them. They have a great dynamic. Listen to them every time they put out an episode. Rigged for Dirt, Frank and Ali, a little bit of Toyota, a little bit of Jeep, a little bit of overlanding. I'm admittedly not a huge overland fan, but I really enjoy the content that they put out. Top tier content, 10 out of 10 would recommend. Built for the East Off-Road, not very consistent, much like me, but they do talk a lot about East Coast wheeling. They do a little van off-roading stuff, which I think is pretty fucking cool. Off-Road Garage Podcast, Jim and Jason, love those guys. Definitely got to check that out. They're out of Michigan, so they talk a little bit funny, but, you know, it's good shit. And last but not least, one of the ones that I have found out about recently is Wheel Every Weekend. Haven't listened to a ton of them. I think I'm up to 5 episodes now, but really liking what I'm hearing, so definitely go check that out. And on that note, let's get into the episode. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Seven Slot Society podcast, the off-road lifestyle podcast that exactly zero of you asked me to do. Today's episode is very special to me because this is someone I look up to as a creative mind and a technical fabricator. This man has multiple SEMA builds under his kilt and has built a respected name for himself within the off-road scene. Ladies and gentlemen, Greg Henderson, dude, thank you so much for giving me a chunk of your extremely busy schedule.
Yay!
Okay, so for the casual off-roader who may not even know what SEMA is, can you give us your elevator pitch of who you are as a human?
Well, SEMA is the Specialty Equipment Manufacturers Association. So I'm just a regular dude, just like everybody else. You know, just like Angel or 8 million other people in Michigan. I just really love tinkering and messing with stuff. And I have a certain skill set, so I've gotten fairly decent at reshaping things to make them look how I think they should look.
Yes. And that
comes in the form of, you know, sheet metal and vehicles and rat rods and cars and Jeeps and really everything. I mean, I even make my own gun stock. So, I love using my hands and I love being creative. So I'm not really your bolt-on wonder guy. Uh-huh. There's definitely a good place for bolt-on parts, but, you know, I'll hand fab my own suspension and hand fab the sheet metal of the vehicle. And, you know, and I do it old school too. A lot of people don't know that, but I don't have any fancy tools. I'm not made of money, and I don't charge enough for what I do. So
I feel like that's a lot of people's problem.
Right. Like Pathkiller, which a lot of people know because I put square headlights on a JK.
Yes.
With a Cherokee front end.
Yes.
And so that build, which, you know, a lot of people in the off-road world recognize when they see it, dude, I did that with a hammer and a dowel.
That's insane.
You know, those front fenders on that, you know, that vehicle fit 37-inch tires with no lift.
Mm-hmm.
So all factory suspension. And those front fenders, I mean, I reshaped by hand with a hammer and dowel and an anvil. You know, I probably hit each one of those fenders no less than 60,000 times with a hammer to get that shape.
I did not know that.
Yeah, like I don't have English wheels. I don't have plasma tables. I don't have, you know, the fancy tools that the big name brand shops have.
Right.
I do everything by hand, like old school, just because, again, I'm not the best businessman in the world, so I don't tend to charge what I should.
And you're more or less a one-man shop, aren't you?
So I've got a couple people that come in and help. You know, this is like Captain Redbeard, who's kind of the awesomest dude in the world. He comes in and helps, but mostly he's more winter based, because in the summer he's building houses.
Okay.
And then you know, I've had a couple other helpers here and there. This summer, my son, who turned 16, is my shop helper.
Hell yes.
So, you know, and we're actually building his first car right now. He's had it for almost 2 years, but he didn't have interest into building it until like 3 weeks ago. So we just pulled it out.
Now it's crunch time.
Yeah, we pulled the mothballs out of it and literally pulled it out of the weeds. And he learned how to do his first oil change and tune up. And he's doing some sheet metal work, and the interior's off to the interior guy. And he didn't want a Jeep. I had like five Jeeps in the backyard I was willing to give him. He didn't want one.
Nothing wrong with that.
Nope. He wanted a muscle car, and he did some searching and found himself a 1972 Dodge Polara.
Nice.
Which a lot of people don't even know what it is or recognize it. But if you look at any of your old movies, any 70s, 80s era movies, you'll see a million Dodge Polaras because they were a very prevalent police car.
Okay.
In fact, the Dodge Polara from 1967 until 2008 was in the Guinness Book as the fastest police car in the world.
That is cool. I remember you telling me that.
Yep. So he's got a Polara. It's got a 360 with a mild cam and a couple goodies, but it sounds like a pissed off hot rod, and he digs it. And, you know, next is as we're in the middle of sheet metal work, it's got to go to the exhaust shop and get some exhaust. And, you know, I'm going to be the good dad, and I'm going to make sure to call Summit and get him some push button exhaust cutouts so that he can piss off the neighbors and make little old ladies pee their pants when he drives by.
Hell yeah. Isn't that the whole point of a muscle car?
Right. You know, and hopefully he'll understand to not do it when he shouldn't, because tickets suck when you're a kid. But,
yes.
You know, I want to give him every chance to have fun. You know, see all these kids nowadays, even all the kids at his school, and their parents are buying them brand new cars. You know, like his girlfriend, who's love her to death, you know, she's the girlfriend, but she was so mad that her parents bought her a 2012.
Because it was too old?
Yeah, because it's an old, she calls it a grandma car because it's too old.
These whippersnappers.
Yeah, and I'm like, wow. You know, I mean, my first car I bought when I was 14, and it was a 1971 CUDA. And, you know, took a long time to put it together, but just the litany of cars that I had when I was a young kid that I paid like $100 for.
Right.
You know, and we're always 20 and 30 years old and piles of junk. And
it builds character.
Right. And even my kid goes to a very small school, and, you know, I pull through the parking lot at school and I see all these brand new JLs.
Jeez.
And I'm like, how in the world do you give a 16-year-old a $40,000 or $50,000 or $60,000 car?
I won't even give myself one. Shit.
Right. The newest thing that I own is a 2012. And that's a cop car that I bought from an auction for $3,000. So,
nice.
You know, I'm like, I guess I just don't understand how it works.
Yeah,
in today's world.
It's crazy now. But speaking of kids, so for my own edification, I don't know a whole lot about this. I want to dig into like your caterpillar stage, if you will. What was little Greg like? Like, where did you grow up? What was your upbringing like? I don't think a lot of people know that.
My caterpillar stage, I was a scrawny little runt of a kid. Like really scrawny. I had huge medical conditions when I was an adolescent, allergic to everything under the sun, and had asthma. So, and I'll bet you, I think when I was 15, I was maybe 120 pounds.
Jeez.
So I was a scrawny little runt. When I was a young kid, pre 10 years old, I started martial arts, because my dad thought it was cool. Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
So, I mean, I played with G.I. Joes and picked my boogers and liked to kick things. So, you know, that was my childhood. We had the fun stuff, right? You know, we lived in I grew up in a very small town in northern Michigan called Elk Rapids.
Okay.
And at the time, it was a super small town. Now it's like a tourist attraction. But, you know, it was regular old middle America. You know, I was born in 1977. And as an adolescent kid, you know, I remember being 5, 6 years old, and we would, you'd pedal your BMX, or I didn't even have a BMX. I had a Schwinn with a banana seat. But, you know, in the mid and early 80s, I would pedal my bike, you know, 6, 7, 8 miles to my cousin's house. And right. That was perfectly acceptable behavior.
Yeah.
And then right as a preteen, when I was just turning 12, my parents uprooted us and we moved to middle of Michigan, which was a town called Howell. And okay. We moved there because my dad, who was in the automotive industry, my dad got this really cool job at this place called Cars and Concepts. Mm-hmm. And he worked with Lee Iacocca and Dave Draper.
Damn.
And some pretty high-end cool people. And so my dad got this job there and moved us, you know, across the state. And, you know, he did some really cool stuff. So I saw a lot of really cool car stuff when I was a kid, but my dad didn't want me to work on cars. So I wasn't really allowed in the garage. I wasn't allowed to touch tools.
Right.
But my dad did just these amazing things and these really, really cool cars. So it was pretty exciting for me. Like he worked on the first Viper and, you know, all these other kind of really cool things. So,
right.
And he also built a lot of hot rods and other stuff when I was a kid, but, he worked there. And then, I think after there, he went to DGE, which was a Chrysler, facility.
Okay.
And mind you, this is like late '80s, early '90s. And in fact, it would have been early '90s. So maybe, you know, 90, 91, my dad started at DGE, which is a Chrysler Corporation, which DGE stood for Damn Good Engineering.
Perfect.
And so he worked there, and then eventually he moved into Chrysler proper, where he met a lot of really cool guys, and guys that I still hang out with today.
Okay.
So, you know, there was Dave Yeagy is the father of the Rubicon, right? Okay. So Dave Yeagy and Jim Rapp, both Chrysler engineers, and both Lunatic Fringe members, are the guys who in their garage at home built the first Rubicon and then showed up at the Rubicon Trail. Let the execs drive it. And you know, people can Google this, and it's a really cool story. But so back in 2002, Dave Yeagy and Jim Rapp built this thing in their garage with begged, borrowed, and stolen parts, and then put it on the semi to go to the Rubicon Trail and let the execs at Jeep drive it. And everybody wanted to drive that one because it did so much better than everything else. And then within a year, we had a model called the Rubicon.
Oh, so that was kind of like their pitch.
Right.
Okay.
So my dad, when Dave Yeagy first started at Chrysler, my dad took Yeagy under his wing and helped him out. But then some of the other guys, Phil Tony and Dave Thompson and Lowell Babcock and Steve Schluter, all these original hardcore Jeep guys who started the Lunatic Fringe, they were friends with my dad, and then eventually they became friends with me. And they've really helped spur along my love of Jeeps and what I do. Because okay. I didn't get into Jeeps until later. It was like, I built a 1977 Ford F-350 in circa like 2002.
Okay.
And I just kept doing stuff to it in the garage, you know, in the garage at home and in the driveway. And eventually I was getting like 3 miles to the gallon. So it was, and gas was cheap then, right? Gas was under $1, but, it got to the point where it was too much as a daily driver. So, my wife at the time, who I had just married, who I'm still married to today, we stopped at a dealership and bought this little red 98 TJ.
Nice.
As my daily driver so that I could get good gas mileage.
Quotes good.
Right. And that's what started my love of Jeep. Even though my dad worked with Jeep and he was friends with all these Jeep people, I wasn't into Jeeps. Right. Until I bought that little 98 TJ. And I built that 3 or 4 times. And then I was really fortunate. I was at a couple off-road things and some magazine people, John Kappa, who at one time was the editor of JP Magazine. And
right.
John Kappa was here and he loved my Jeep. He took pictures of it. I made the cover of a magazine. And I was like, you know, that was just the coolest thing in the world for me at the time. And I just kept doing that. You know, my fun and my hobby was Jeeps. Yeah. And then fast forward a couple more years, 2006, end of 2006, early 2007, there was this little known Jeep company was moving into Michigan. And Dave Yeagy, who we already mentioned, Dave Yeagy left his job at Chrysler as head of JK development. And basically he quit and started working at AEV.
Okay.
So he asked me if I could help them get a couple of vehicles ready for Easter Jeep Safari in 2007. And conveniently, the job that I had at the time, I was a union bricklayer and I was a foreman, so I could kind of make my own hours.
Right.
I took a leave of absence from work and I helped knock out a couple Brutes and a couple JKs for Easter Jeep Safari in 2007. And I never left. You know, I at the end of getting the vehicles ready, they asked me if I wanted to go to Easter Jeep Safari with AEV.
Right.
And at the time, I wasn't even an employee. And I was like, yeah, dream. So I went and spent the week with them, had a lot of fun. And on the way home, I was offered a job and I accepted it. The funny part was it was a huge pay cut.
Oh, I bet. You know,
as a union bricklayer, and one of only 117 stonemasons in the state, I went from like $140,000 a year to like barely $40,000 a year.
Oh, that hurts. How was that explaining to your wife?
Well, you know, one, we were young, you know, a lot younger than we are today. We were young and we had a really fat bank account because we were smart with our money and saved everything. So we were, you know, financially we were in a great place, and my wife, you know, God bless her heart, she was like, look, if this is something that you're passionate about and want to do, go for it.
Aren't those so, kind of women the best?
Yeah.
The absolute best.
And we screwed up like 85 million times during the relationship, but yes, they're still the best.
Yes. So, I'm surprised I'm still married, honestly.
So, you know, she was like, go for it. And I did it and I loved it. I absolutely loved AEV. I loved the job. I loved the position. You know, I kind of ran the shop. I was the head tech, the head fabricator, the head welder. But I didn't stop there, right? I wanted to learn every single aspect about that business. So, you know, if I had 5 minutes of downtime, I would run over and help the warehouse guys, or I would, you know, just do everything I could to learn everything about it. And I'm kind of like that, right? I never stop wanting to learn stuff. So I had a blast. You know, it was a great job, and it kept getting more and more corporate,
right?
You know, as they grew. But mind you, when I started, I was the 11th employee ever for AEV.
Oh, shit.
And at the time, there was only 7 people total that worked for AEV when I started. And, you know, when I left in 2014, we had like 60 employees.
Oh, wow.
You know, so there was a massive amount of growth. So it had to get corporate.
Right.
You know, and we went from when I started, we would, you know, custom build your Jeep to your specifications and all that, to by the end of my career there, it was, these are your 3 options, you pick it, and that's what we built. You know, there was no more custom, there was no more, you know, excitement in that end of the build.
Right.
And, you know, when when I separated from AEB in 2014, I wasn't in the shop anymore. I was, I wrote all the instructions. I was the head of the tech department. So, you know, when people called, I was the answer man.
Right.
And I did inside sales and I sold all the takeoff parts. So I still wore a lot of hats, but, you know, still no hard feelings, love the place. Still love the products they make. I think they're still one of the only companies that makes everything to OE standards.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they're pretty good.
Yeah.
But then I, you know, and one of the reasons I left was my son got hurt really, really bad.
Mm-hmm.
And after my son got hurt, like I didn't work for months.
Right.
Because I was at the hospital and then just taking care of my son. And when I finally went back, you know, AEB never stopped. They never stopped supporting me through the whole thing. I never got a, you know, you need to come back to work tomorrow or you don't have a job. There was none of that.
Right.
They were amazing. So, but it was still hard. And, you know, I went from being a guy who would work 90 hours a week to a guy who didn't work for months.
Right.
And then, when I left, you know, there was a minor conflict of interest. I had built this Jeep called Frankenbrut and I was going to all the big shows. So I was taking a lot of time off of work and going to all the big shows to raise awareness for shaken baby syndrome, which is what happened to my son.
Right.
And it was just the right time. So we separated. I didn't do anything for a couple months, other than some side jobs in my garage. And then I ended up picking up a job down in Florida, the COO of a company.
Okay.
And I went down there for like 6 months, 6.5 months. And never moved to the family, right? I went down solo and decided very early on that I wasn't going to move my family. So, ended up coming back home, did some help with some other companies, you know, designing some parts and products and helping with marketing and whatnot. And then I just said, screw it, and started my own little company called Unofficial Use Only and started building one of ones for companies who don't build their own.
Right.
You know, like the first one that really made a splash that was 100% me was Pascular. Previous to that, I had already built over 10 SEMA cars, but I'd always built them for somebody else, you know, whether it was working on it for a Chrysler job or for AEB or something else.
Right.
But Pascular was the very first one that I could say 100% me, my design, my idea, my everything. And that was for a company called MyTop. You know, they commissioned the build. And then I've done a few other ones. I've had Jeeps in Super Winch's booth. I've had Jeeps in R1 Concepts booth, Rip Superchargers booth, you know, and a few others at SEMA.
Right.
And, you know, even this year, or actually it was last year, I was commissioned to do a SEMA build for last year, which then SEMA was canceled. So I didn't even start the build until it was a little late. But,
right.
You know, I did the YJL for Quadratec.
Yes.
And
one of my favorites. Know,
yeah. And they just basically said, hey, will you build this? And I was like, yep, in a heartbeat.
A question going back to Pathkiller real quick, was that, so you said that was your first major build that was all you, did they kind of give you creative control on that or did they still have like things that you needed to hit?
No, I demanded creative control.
I said that. Smart.
So what they, you know, the original sit down with them was, They wanted to do a SEMA booth and they had done a SEMA booth for 4 years and they wanted to do a SEMA booth. But they couldn't figure out why nobody ever walked into their SEMA booth. They're like, you know, we do the SEMA booth every year and it's not really worth it because nobody comes into our booth.
Right.
And I told them, I was like, well, it's because you're building. And I hate to say it this way, but I told them, I was like, you're building JC Whitney Jeeps. Right.
Cookie cutters.
Right. And they're not even just cookie cutters. They're like, you're putting garbage on a Jeep and then expecting that people are going to come into your booth.
Right.
I said, you know, if you want the magazines to come into your booth and you want, you know, the people to come into your booth and people to just randomly take a picture of your vehicle, you got to do something that grabs everybody's attention. And having a marketing guy who came from a restaurant business has no business telling you how to build a Jeep. The guy doesn't even know how to put it in four-wheel drive. So, you know, you got a 60-year-old marketing guy who came from restaurants and has never put a Jeep in four-wheel drive. He's not the guy that should be telling you how to build a Jeep.
Absolutely.
So I told him, I said, if I can have 100% creative control, I will build your Jeep. You just write checks and shut up.
Those are the best customers.
And they agreed to it.
Was there any pushback at all at first?
Never. Not even once.
That's a dream client, man.
Yeah, they did a couple little tiny pushbacks, like when I told them I wasn't going to put a lift on it. Uh-huh. You know, the marketing guy's like, oh no, every Jeep at SEMA's got to have, you know, a 6-inch lift in 40s. And I was like, no. You know, you can just take the Jeep back and finish it on your own.
Right.
And, you know, I explained to them what I was going to do, and they had no concept. When I was like, well, I'm going to do a throwback build. What's that? You know? And then I said, well, I took some measurements on a Cherokee, and it's going to fit. And I said, you know, the reason I wanted to do a Cherokee, there was a couple reasons. One was, you know, throwback builds are always popular because the people with money, the people who are adults now, before they were adults, they were teenagers. And when they were teenagers and preteens, they opened the magazines, and what they saw is what they liked. So, you know, the guys who are in their 40s now and 50s grew up with XJs. So if you build a Jeep that looks like what they grew up with, they're going to like it.
Right. That nostalgia factor.
Right. And at the time, that was 2016, there was a couple throwback builds out there. Chrysler just did one that they called the Chief, and it was blue. And they actually put they put the front end from the new Kaiser on it. But it was a JK with a, you know, 70s inspired Wagoneer front clip.
Right.
So that was out there. And the year before that, they had actually done a Cherokee Chief. So I didn't want to do a Chief because there was already stuff like that out there. And there was a company at the time, Bavarian, who had just developed a fiberglass front clip that looked like kind of Cherokee Chiefish.
Right.
So I couldn't do a Chief, and I wanted to do something that was just going to grab a lot of attention. And I wanted to do something where I could use some brand new parts. So I called a guy named Dave Logan, and Dave Logan was part of Omic Zeta. He ran the museum. So he's a guy that I know, and he's like the vice president of the National Four Wheel Drive Association. So a good dude with a huge off-road background. And I called him and I said, hey, I'm going to do a build that's going to be in this booth at SEMA, you know, because you give them the booth numbers. And I said, I want to take a JK and put an XJ front end on it. And Omic Zeta makes all those parts.
Right.
So they make brand new fenders and brand new hoods and brand new grills and all the bits that you need for your XJ, you can buy it brand new from Omic Zeta. Mm-hmm. And they even have the original tooling. So they got the tooling from Chrysler. So the parts are stamped on the original tools, right? So I'm like, perfect. And I told Logan what I was doing, and he laughed at me, and he's like, good luck. He's like, I'll send you the parts, but I don't know if it's going to look good. So he sent me the parts and I got to work. And originally I was going to put a lift on it until I started reshaping those front fenders. And when I was reshaping the front fenders, and I used Notch Customs makes some really, really nice factory looking flares for an XJ. Uh-huh. So I used their front flares, but I actually opened up the fenders a lot wider than even their flares allow so that it would fit the lines of the JK.
Right.
And eventually, you know, hey, 37s will fit with no lift. So there's no reason to make it any bigger.
Yeah, definitely.
And then I paint, you know, when we painted it, because the Jeep started white, and I know I didn't want it to be white, and my top had a litany of colors. Like they had like 30 colors to choose from. If you wanted a MyTop, you could have it custom made in all these colors.
Right.
So I went through the color palette and I found this beautiful gray that looked like, you know, an 80s or 90s paint job color. And I was like, that's the color. So we color matched the paint to the top, so that it would work.
It looks so, so good from all the pictures mm-hmm. I've seen. I wasn't at SEMA that year, but all those pictures, I have it pulled up right now. That gray is fucking mint, dude.
Yeah. So we did that gray. And then, you know, a lot of people ask about the accents. Like there's a green accent color.
Right.
And that was a nod to not only Jeep, but also to JCR and our servicemen. So when Jeep did it the first time, they were doing a version of the Cherokee and they put a red line around the six slot. Then it kind of stands for I've got your six.
Okay. I didn't know
which
that.
Which is a nod to service personnel and military. And then JCR built this really wicked XJ and they did the same thing. The six slot over, they put a colored ring around it. And I'm like, I thought it looked really cool. So when I was doing Pathkiller, when I was talking with the painter, I did the same thing. I was like, I want this to be green. And I showed him the green and he's like, that won't work. That's ugly. And I'm like, I don't care. This is what I want. You're going to do it. So I showed it to him and, he did that. He painted the grill first and then the seats in that were pretty cool. And it was a huge endeavor to do those seats, but, they were the factory JK seats, mm-hmm. but because it was going to SEMA, I had to, you know, kick it up a notch.
Right.
And so I got a hold of Roadwire leather. Normally I use catskin leather, but Roadwire leather was friends with the guys who did the MyTop anyway. So got a hold of Roadwire and I was like, this is what I want. And I drew a sketch and I said, I want the seats to look like this. And I told them I would provide the fabric. So I wanted leather seats, but I wanted a fabric centerpiece in the seat.
Right.
And I wanted it to be, you know, like a flannel based because, you know, skinny jeans and beards and flannels are cool. Right. So, but I wanted a flannel base, but I wanted it to touch close to home too. So if you find pictures of the interior of that vehicle, and you can find them on my Facebook or on Unofficial You Sold Me, but,
I have it pulled up on Motor Trend right now, actually.
So those, that plaid mm-hmm. is actually the Henderson tartan.
Really?
So, cause you know, like you mentioned right in the beginning, you know, under my kilt.
Yeah.
So yeah, I wear kilts and the Henderson tartan, I had to get a hold of a company in Scotland that manufactures that tartan.
No shit.
I had to priority overnight because nobody had any in the United States. So I had to priority overnight three reams of fabric from Scotland to here. And then once it arrived here, I had to priority overnight it to Mexico.
Holy shit.
Because the manufacturing facility for Roadwire, the place that actually sews the seats together, was in Mexico. So priority overnighted it here, then priority overnighted it to Mexico at a great expense. I think it cost me like $1,200 to ship that stuff.
Most expensive and, seats ever.
Oh, it gets worse. So then they, Roadwire, and I literally, I took the old seats and I, with China marker, I drew all over the seats, you know, fabric here, stitching here, you know, this color here, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And I sent the seats with it. So there's no way anybody could mess that up.
Yeah.
So then they shipped this, you know, it was like a week later, the seat cover showed up and I opened the box and my stomach literally fell out.
Oh God, because no.
Because they had it like all backwards and twisted and, you know, it was just 100% wrong. And I'm like, I called the Roadwire guy and I was like, I hope they didn't throw away any remaining fabric. And so he calls and back and forth. And yes, they had enough of the tartan to do more because they were supposed to have enough tartan. They were supposed to ship the leftover tartan back with the seats and they didn't.
Okay.
Because I was going to do some other accessories with the tartan.
Right.
But, so then they had to make a second set of seats in like a 10 hours and then fly them to Detroit.
Jesus. So hopefully that, so at their expense.
Oh, all at their expense at this point. And they did. They knocked them right out of the park. They were great. They went in the car, no issues. But, oh, man, I mean, I was just sick to my stomach because I had, at that time, I had like 2 days to be inside of a van on my way to SEMA.
Classic SEMA schedule.
Yeah. You know, and it was funny, like that build, and SEMA always does this. You know, I mean, I'm sure you've heard stories and other people and your listeners have heard stories, but the very first, that particular build, the very first company that I talked to and said, hey, I'm going to build this thing. It's going to get some attention. I want to put your part on it. And, you know, how much is it going to cost?
Right.
And they're like, I'm not the type of guy, I don't ask for freebies, right? Mm-hmm. How much is it going to cost? Tell me what it's going to cost. I'll just pay it. I don't care.
Right.
You know, and some companies, when it's a SEMA quality build, yes, they will sponsor the build and you'll pay a much smaller fee than retail, or sometimes you'll even get the parts for free. Mm-hmm. The very first company that was like, I want to be part of that build. I want our stuff on the build. They were the last ones to send the product.
Oh no.
Like the vehicle's painted and done and in reassembly before they sent their product. And they're like, can you put it on? And I did, I put it on, but I shouldn't have. I should have told them right then, and excuse my French, I'm bad at swearing, but I should have told them right then, fuck you.
Right.
You know, because they created 40 hours of extra work by sending their part so late in the game.
Yeah, I feel like they should know better.
But they don't. It happens every year. And usually SEMA builds are the only reason that you hit SEMA crunch is because of those parts.
Okay.
Like even right now, the YJL for Quadratec, which, you know, aesthetically it was done November last year. And okay. Quadratec showed it off, you know, in December, and then they brought it to Easter Jeep Safari and went wheeling with it and showed it off. But other than that, since Easter Jeep Safari, it's literally just been sitting in my driveway waiting for the parts for this year's SEMA.
Oh, I was going to say, I thought that one was done.
Well, cosmetically, it was done.
Okay.
But it's not done. So, you know, there was a stage two to get it ready for SEMA this year. And 90% of those parts were ordered in February, and I still don't have them.
Jeez.
So, you know, it's like we ordered in February. We didn't wait till June or July or August. We ordered in February so that, you know, we could go over it with a fine-tooth comb and there was never going to be a crunch.
Exactly.
And now we're getting closer and closer to SEMA, and I'm waiting on big parts, like engines and transmissions and transfer cases and
holy shit.
So
they just expect you to not sleep for the 2 months prior to SEMA.
Right. So when those parts come in, I mean, it's going to start SEMA crunch time because it's the worst time of the year. And I have to take that build that you like and strip it all the way down to a frame.
Oh, Jesus.
And put a motor in it that's not designed to be in it, and put a transmission and a transfer case in it that are not designed to be in it.
Of course, because why would you leave the stock stuff in there?
Right, because it works perfect. So, you know, it's just going to be a big one, and it's normal. That stuff happens.
Yeah.
But I think 90, in my personal experience, 90% of SEMA crunch is purely based on sponsored parts.
Just waiting. People are dragging their feet.
Right. And like this, the YJL for Quad, right? Quad's not a small company.
Right.
They're not sponsored parts. They're paying for, you know, I don't know everything that they're paying for because, right, it's not my job to know.
Right.
But I know that they're paying for, like, the engine. And it's going to be cool and it's going to be badass. And I'm so stoked about this engine that's coming. But, you know, it's not like they're getting a freebie because it's going to SEMA. They're paying thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. And we've still been waiting since February.
That's got to be so stressful. Like, do you go to sleep thinking about this stuff?
Yes. Yes, 100%. You know, I think we've deviated a lot from your original question, but you know, that's just kind of how it goes. You know, in and amongst everything else that we all deal with, right? This is my job, right. Which is 100% self-induced. It's my fault that this is my job, but you know, so I've got on my property right now, I have 11 acres, and on my property, I have no less than probably 30 automobiles.
Jeez.
In different states of disrepair, right? some of them, I have a few personal projects that just sit out there and languish, which makes me cry.
Right.
And would make other people cry if they knew what some of them were.
Right.
You know, I've got an all original 1986 J20 that only has 40,000 miles.
No shit.
That I picked up 3 years ago, and I did an oil change on it, and I haven't touched it since.
Oh, that's heartbreaking, dude.
You know, and it's all original, almost 100% rust free, solid body, 360 low miles. You know, I mean, I could, if I pulled it into the shop and spent a half a day on it, it could be a daily driver.
Isn't that rare where you guys are in Michigan, the no rust?
Super rare.
Damn.
And it's a 1986 J20, which there was only like 1,200 of them built.
Oh, wow. So, I did not know that number.
Yep, it was the last year and literally like almost zero production numbers. I got some other stuff. I have an Egyptian military T1 sitting in my backyard.
Oh, shit.
Which, you know, most of the listeners probably don't even know what it is, but the Egyptian military T1 was a TJ that was built specifically for the Egyptian military. So it was a military contract that Jeep did, and they built them in the mid to late 2000s. Eventually it was replaced by the military J8, which was, a diesel version of the JK. But the TJ version was a diesel TJ that was built, and it was a 116-inch wheelbase TJ. So it had the same wheelbase as a four-door JK, but it was a TJ.
Right.
So I've got one of those sitting in the backyard.
I just pulled up a picture. Holy shit, that is cool.
Yeah. You know, and then I have some customer rigs that a couple of them have been languishing here for far too long. I've got a 55 Studebaker mild resto mod that I've been doing for a customer that's been here for years, mostly because the paint shop had it for 3.5 years.
Holy shit.
Well, that was because the customer made the deal with the paint shop. So
I gotcha.
Instead of me, I've got another one that's been here. We're going on a year and a half now. It's a 1975 Cherokee Chief that showed up with an LSA motor. It was actually at SEMA.
Okay.
And my customer bought it from SEMA and shipped it here and then came up with 80 things they wanted me to do to it before it got shipped over to South Africa. And I'm currently at 17 months waiting on the axles.
Holy shit. And that's something you said you're shipping to South Africa?
Yeah, when it's done, it'll go to South Africa.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, nobody makes just turnkey axles for that model Jeep.
Right.
First. Second, the customer wanted a very specific axle. So he wanted Ultimate Dana 60s to be torn apart and reconfigured to fit under a 75 Cherokee Chief.
Oh, jeez.
And then he wanted ox lockers instead of Eaton's. So, you know, so it's not like it was a small job anyway.
Right.
Axles, you know, very specific. So I called around to multiple places. You know, I talked to Dynatrack. I talked to lots of different companies. And then I picked the little guy, right? I was like, you know what? I'll pick the little guy who was based out of Michigan.
Right.
And I hate to say it, but you know, probably one of the worst decisions, because now I'm 17 months in. And mind you, they had problems with getting parts from Dana and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Because of the pandemic. But the axles finally showed up here like 4 months ago. And I let them sit for like a week before I opened the box.
Right.
Because I wasn't ready to work on it. And then I walked out all excited and opened the box, and oops, they put Eaton's on it instead of the aux lockers, which were on the invoice.
Oh, jeez, dude.
So then they had to pick them back up, ship them back to wherever, rebuild them. And I got a message the other day that they're finally showing up. So maybe I can get back on that car.
Jeez.
You know,
reading is essential.
Yeah. Well, and you know, when the first contact is, can you build this and this and this? And the answer is yes, yes, and yes, and this is the price. And then a year later, they show up wrong. It's kind of a, you know, to me, it's kind of a problem.
Yeah, that's a little bad taste in your mouth.
Right. And, but oh boy, they cashed that, you know, $15,000.
Oh, of course, with a hurry.
Right away.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when they sent the wrong stuff, I sent some messages, you know, right to the owner, and I'm like, hey, this is a problem, blah, blah, blah. And it's like I was ghosted for a couple of days, and I started to get really mad. So I went to the bank and I did a stop order on the check, and lo and behold, it, immediately within 20 minutes of the stop order, I was getting texted back.
Oh, imagine that.
Right. You know, and stuff like that happens. And I understand 100% that the vast majority, probably 60% of the uh-ohs were because of the pandemic. And the pandemic has screwed up getting parts so bad.
Right.
But, you know, when you've got an order to build axles with a locker, an aux locker, you don't put an Eaton in them.
Exactly.
Right. Especially when you've had the order for almost a year before you started building the axles.
Yeah, you had had all that ready to go.
Right.
Yeah, there's definitely, I feel like, some room for understanding due to the pandemic, but at the end of the day, there should be no waiting 4 days to hear back.
Right, and we all make mistakes. I mean, even
absolutely.
Me, right?
Absolutely.
I try and build cool shit. I screw up too, right? We all make mistakes. It's just, we're humans. But if I make a mistake and you catch it because I didn't, I don't care if your Jeep is in Georgia. I'm going to fix it right now.
Right.
Right. Whether I have to get in a car and drive to you, or I have to get a hold of a shop or somebody that I know in your area and get it taken care of. Right. I'm not going to let that languish.
Right. Absolutely.
So, and I mean, you know, I got some stuff languishing, right? I've got some really cool rigs here. Like I've got a 1961 Willys Fleet Van, which most people probably don't know what that is.
I definitely know what that is.
Okay. Well, I've got one here. If you troll my Instagram, you'll find a rendering of it that I posted last year. And the whole goal is to build this for this dude. And he's just this awesome dude out in Arizona. His name's Dave Adams. And he lives in a wheelchair, right? Lives his life in a wheelchair.
Right.
And he's a huge Jeep guy. So, you know, we talked back and forth, and somebody else had this Jeep and he got this Jeep. And, you know, it needs a full rotisserie restoration.
Right.
But the skin is there. Right. And it's a wicked little Jeep. So we hatched this plan to turn it into a handicap accessible van so that he can literally drive his wheelchair into the back of it and then drive her out.
That's going to be so sick.
Right. But without the assistance of another human being, because right now, if he wants to get in his car and drive, somebody else has to physically help him into his car.
Right.
And David is an amazing off-roader and a hardcore off-roader, but same thing. He needs help to get into his car. So the fleet van, the premise and the goal is that he can literally just get in it all by himself with no help from another human being. and drive and do his daily chores.
Right.
The problem with it is funding, right? We have this beautiful idea and this beautiful plan, and then life happened to poor Dave, and, you know, he got in an accident, and then he had house problems and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So the plan has been hatched. The vehicle's here. I bought a new chassis and a new powertrain and everything for it. But I'm not made of money, so I can't stop everything I'm doing and work on it.
Exactly.
Unless I'm getting paid. But that's like a dream build sitting in the backyard, you know, a Willys fleet van.
That's 80-inch
wheelbase.
That's a lot of people's dream builds.
Oh yeah. You know, and we're going to, it'll be streetable, right? It's not going to be off road.
Right.
The original fleet vans are just 2-wheel drive,
right?
But they are on a CJ3B chassis. So it's just a wicked little thing that I can't wait to build, but I'm not inherently wealthy. You know, if I won the lottery tomorrow, I'd build it just for fun and give it to them.
Right. Or if you started charging, you know, what you're worth.
Yeah, but I'd have to charge everybody else what I'm worth.
That's
to do
true.
Something like that for him.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, I don't know how to charge, you know, like, I've got friends who build some really wicked stuff. There's a dude in Pennsylvania who's just, he builds some really cool cars and he's got just a great crew, but, you know, talking to him and finding out that he's charging, you know, $250,000 for some of these builds and more. And I'm like, how do you do that?
Yeah.
How do you charge that? But I guess that's, you know, that's business, and I'm bad at business.
Dude, I definitely am. People hit me up and just ask me for like little shit, like stickers, and I'll be like, yeah, no problem. Don't worry about it. Spend 3 hours on it. I don't charge them a dime.
Oh, well, I mean, I do even worse, right? We hand milled these badges that say Unofficial Use Only, and, you know, they're kind of cool and unique. And I only made a small handful of them because the amount of time and effort it took to make them was so enormous.
Right.
And a couple of years ago when I first made them, I actually took one and I stamped into the back of it this dude's name, and I clear coated it and made it all fancy and nice. And I was like, dude, I'll send that to you. Give me your address. And he sent me his address and all that. And it's still sitting in my toolbox. In fact, I'm looking at it right now. oh, look, on the back of it, it says Angel.
I remember that phone call.
Dude, I have it right here in my hand. It's still in my hand. You know, so, and it's just, you know, you get so busy doing 8 million other things, and running to the post office is one of those things that I just don't do very often. And then when I do it, I'm like, oh, fuck, I should have grabbed that and put it in a box.
I am right you there know? With you, dude, right there with you.
I even brought it to Easter Jeep Safari just in the hopes that I would see you.
I'm not cool enough to go to EJS yet.
Well, I would have hired you.
Oh, well, shit, I didn't know that.
Well, so this year I was hired, Unofficial Use Only was hired to handle all the logistics on the ground and man the Dixie 4-wheel drive expo.
Oh, nice.
So when the Red Rock 4-wheelers and the town couldn't work out all the BS,
right,
the Red Rock 4-wheelers decided that they were not going to do a vendor show based on issues with the township.
Mm-hmm.
And Dixie 4-wheel drive is in a different county, even though it's like you could throw a golf ball from one spot to the other, it's still a different county.
Right.
So Bryce at Dixie decided that he would hold an event and he would set his property up for it. And Bryce and the marketing team got together, and then they called me and asked if I would handle all the ground logistics. So I actually had to hire 10 people to work Easter Jeep Safari. So if you would have let me know, I would have just given you money to go to Easter Jeep Safari.
I'll keep that in mind for next year.
we're actually, and this is preemptive, but we're already talking about next year. And there's even if Red Rock does one next year, there's a high probability that we will also be doing something, whether it's a vendor show or something just for to make it a better experience for everybody that goes to EJS.
Right. I'm assuming it, what you guys did went really well, or else they wouldn't be thinking about doing it again.
It went really, really, really well. We had, you know, and it was a first year event. So it was, and we only had 5.5 weeks to plan the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
We ended up with like 120 vendors.
Holy shit.
And, you know, we had almost 10 acres of property taken up. Ford was there with 40 Broncos, and Jeep was there with 392s and giving rides, and, you know, everybody else, Warren and Factor 55, and, you know, all of the companies, Rockslide Engineering and Quadratech, and everybody was there. So it turned out to be a really, really good event. You know, bonus, I think some of the vendors were there just because they did not have the avenue that was happened that would have normally happened by the Red Rock.
Right.
But yeah, it was still a really wicked, really wicked week. It was a lot of fun. It was also my worst Easter Jeep Safari that I've ever attended.
Do tell.
Normally when I go to Easter Jeep Safari, I spend from sunup till sundown on the trails,
right,
and trail guiding. And, you know, I guide for different companies and, you know, different groups. And I, you know, that's how I get paid. That's how I afford Easter Jeep Safari.
Right.
And this year I was running the logistics for a giant off-road event. So for 5-6 days of Easter Jeep Safari, I was standing in a gravel parking lot. Well, everybody else, you know, they'd come in off the trail and they'd need something welded or fixed. And, you know, I'd help with that because we were at Dixie. But, you know, for 6 days of Easter Jeep Safari, I stood in a parking lot.
That's terrible.
And when the sun would go down, if I wasn't too tired, I could go do some wheeling. And I did. I took a bunch of new people. I had a group of people who had never been to EJS before.
On a night run?
One guy driving a 1947 Willys. Another guy driving a YJ on 31-inch tires. And then some really capable rigs. But the very first night run I took all these guys on was Moab Rim.
Jeez, dude.
You know, and so we, you know, we did. We go up to the top of Moab Rim, check everything out, come back down, all in pitch black darkness. But I do that a lot when I take people to Moab. Moab Rim is like my favorite trail. And I like to go all the way. I always like to take everybody all the way because most people never take people all the way on Moab Rim. Most people go up to the top, look out over Moab, and then come back down the hill. There's so much more to that trail. When you get to the top, you just drive a little bit. There's a couple hot tubs. There's small hot tubs, but there's a couple little hot tubs. There's also some really cool off camber kind of V notches that you can play in. There's a sand dune section on Moab Rim that's like a 400 foot sand hill climb.
Holy shit.
There's also, if you finish the trail out, you go all the way to the end, you have to hike a couple hundred yards. But if you do it, you hike a couple hundred yards and there's a spot, there's this beautiful little crevasse. You can climb it like it's a ladder. And on top of that crevasse, there's a hand stacked Indian fort that's well over 1,000 years old.
No shit.
There's also a wall around the backside of that you walk to. There's a wall that has thousands and thousands of Indian petroglyphs on it that are all, you know, anywhere between 1,000 and 2,000 years old.
Oh my God. I nerd out so hard about that stuff. Like, I love off-road, but that, like, history shit, I fucking love.
Oh, dude, if you go to EJS next year, if you put it on your bucket list and you go, seriously look me up, because every day I take people on adventures like that. So do a cool, last year in October, we did the Moab 4x4 Expo and I was one of the celebrity trail guides.
Uh-huh.
And one of the trails I did was Moab Rim with Fred Williams. And Fred had done Moab Rim, I think he told me like 30 or 40 times, right? He's been up and down that trail for years.
I bet. Yeah.
And I took him and, you know, our group all the way to that spot. And he's like, he was blown away. I even have a picture of us standing there. He's like, I've done this trail dozens of times. I didn't know this existed.
Oh,
I didn't know this was here.
Awesome.
You know, so, but there's so much stuff like that in Moab. And a lot of people don't realize that you've got, you know, Hell's Revenge, which is a super popular trail, right?
Right.
Everybody's heard of Hell's Revenge. 80% of people that do Hell's Revenge don't know that 10 minutes into the trail, you can stand inside of dinosaur footprints that are millions of years old.
Oh, shit.
You know, like they're literally on the trail. So as you're, you enter Hell's Revenge, you go over the first fin, and then you've got a little wash that you drive through. And then there's like this 300 yard long section of like a gravel road that you drive on.
Uh-huh.
At the halfway point of that gravel road, if you actually just stop and get out of your Jeep, you can put your feet in dinosaur footprints that have been there for millions of years.
That's insane.
And, you know, so that's a cool spot. There's also just outside of town, on the south end of town, there's the man-made caves that are carved into one of the walls. And they're right next to one of the entrances for Steelbender.
Okay.
But, when you go to that, one of the entrances for Steelbender, you turn right. If you don't turn right, if you turn left on accident and you drive 100 yards, A, you do a beautiful little creek crossing, and then right in the side of the wall, there's the caves that were hand-carved into the mountain where they filmed the original Planet of the Apes with Charlton Heston. And it's on public property, so you can literally walk. You can walk right into these caves, right?
Holy shit, that's blowing my mind right now. I had no idea about any of this.
So every year during EJS, I'll take at least one day and take a group of people that are interested in this, and I'll take them to all these spots in one day. We'll just drive around and hit these spots.
Yeah.
Then there's another one when if you pass Moab Rim, the entrance to Moab Rim, and it's on Cane Creek Road, right, and it runs along the Colorado River. As you're passing it, there's a little tiny canyon on the left, and if you blink you'll miss it, but there's a little tiny parking lot, and there's usually an outhouse there, and people can tent in that canyon. It's called Moonflower Canyon, and it's beautiful.
Okay.
But at the entrance to that canyon, literally 3 feet off of the road, there's it's called the Indian Ladder, and it's a natural crevasse inside the stonework of the cliff. And you can get into this crevasse and climb up the Indian Ladder. It's been there for like 1,000 years. And you have this beautiful overlook of the Colorado River. And, you know, you can see a couple miles in each direction. But there's also dozens of Indian petroglyphs right there. there's another, you can go to the spot where they filmed, what was that movie with the two girls that drove off the cliff? Why can't I think of it?
I don't know.
Famous. They're in like a red T-bird. They drove off a cliff. Brad Pitt was in the movie.
Oh shit, I don't know. Is it older?
Yeah, it's like 90s.
Oh.
But it was a really famous movie. I just can't remember the name of it because it was a chick flick. But you know, you can go there, you can go to where that happened, you can go just outside of town. Right off the expressway, so right off I-70. If you leave Moab and you head towards Grand Junction, I think it's the first or second exit. There's a Marathon gas station. If you go to that gas station, then you just pass it. There's this little itty bitty ghost town that you drive through. And then you drive, you're essentially driving north away from the highway on this little one lane blacktop road. And if you've ever watched the Discovery Channel or the History Channel back in the day, and you saw the alien conspiracy TV shows,
yeah,
they would always show these aliens that were like 15 feet tall and painted in red and had space, you know, flying saucers and stuff.
Right.
That's right there. It's 10 minutes outside of town.
No shit.
and those are considered the oldest Indian petroglyphs in the world.
Oh, wow.
So they're, I forget the exact carbon dating, but I think some of them go up to like 25,000 years old.
Holy shit.
So all that stuff is right there in Moab. You also have Moab is it's inside of what they call the dinosaur diamond. So if you're into rocks, there's you can literally walk around. I know a bunch of spots where you can walk around and just pick dinosaur bones up and put them in your pocket.
Holy shit.
I'm trying to think some of the other stuff. I mean, uranium. So a lot of the trails in Moab were cut by uranium miners back, you know, before World War II and during World War II.
Right.
Because Moab was basically built on uranium. So when you're doing a lot of the trails, like you go out to 7 Mile Rim or Metal Masher or, you know, a bunch of these trails, if you know where to look, you'll be driving along and you'll see these 4-inch and 6-inch core holes. So they're holes cut right into the rock that we drive over. Right. Most people don't even notice them, but they're hundreds of feet deep, you know? So you pull up next to one of them, and way back in the day, when you'd go on a tour, the guys would like take your pop can or your beer can and drop it down the hole. Then you could listen to it clink, 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 clink for, you know, like a minute before it hit the bottom.
Holy shit.
You can't do that anymore, right? That's littering. That's bad. Don't hurt the environment. But
don't do that.
Right. But there is one really cool one of those holes, and it's on the trail 7 Mile Rim. And when you get to it, if you have a good guide or somebody who knows what it is, everybody stops, you get out, and you look down the hole, and it's close enough to the face of the cliff. You know, it's like maybe 50 feet from the face of the cliff.
Uh-huh.
When you look down the hole, you can see a couple hundred feet down daylight because there's a huge fissure and cave system in the face of the mountain that when they cored that hole, it goes all the way through that cavern, so you can see the cavern from a couple hundred feet above it. I mean, there's like all this little cool stuff in Moab, and it's not just like, for me, it's not just about the off-roading, it's about all these cool things that you can find and learn. And you know, all off-roading should be that, because most of the trails that we have are based off of somebody trying to get somewhere at some point in time,
right?
So you know, don't just go do a trail because you saw it on Instagram. Go do a trail and research it and find out how it started and what's there. And, you know, there might be spots like a quarter mile off the trail where there's an old ghost town or something else that, you know, you can see and learn history. It's just, to me, that's the coolest part.
Yeah, shit. I'm going to have to take you with me out for a week there off season and we can see all this shit.
Dude,
that would be fucking anytime. Sick.
My family loves it. So, you know, the kids, my wife's a huge rock hound, and Liam loves doing that stuff with his mom, and Tommy's getting geeked about off-roading. So any chance we get to go to Moab, we're in.
Hell yeah. Shit. So, Dave, you like blew my fucking mind. I have a whole list of notes here, and I'm fucking speechless.
Dude, I'm huge. I am a wealth of useless information.
Well, honestly, I think the majority of people that listen to this don't know what you've been talking about for the past half hour, I would venture to say.
Well, you know, what I should do is, instead of being guests on these podcasts, I should just start my own and blow everybody out of the water.
Exactly. Just record it on your phone. You put one out as you're working. Be the fastest growing off-road podcast.
Oh, well, I was thinking I should just put up, you know, like hook up like 8 or 9 GoPros and stuff all around the shop. And just live stream my daily business.
There's
everything I do. You can watch me. You can watch me smoke 2 packs of Marlboro Lights and work on cars.
That sounds like a good subscription model.
Yeah. And drink a case of Mountain Dew.
Oof, my teeth hurt.
But the cool part is, like right behind the shop, and a lot of people don't know this either, but right behind my shop, I actually built a 7-acre off-road park. So when we get done building them, I can go right in the backyard and test them. So customers of mine, before they get to drive away with their Jeep, they get to go in the backyard and learn what it's capable of, from proper recovery to how steep of a side hill you can do to the nastiest rocks you can drive over. It's all right behind my building, and most people don't know it's there except my customers.
So what you're saying is I need to come out there for a couple of days and do like a full YouTube series on what you got going on there.
Oh, yeah. You can. You're more than welcome.
I think people might enjoy that.
Yeah.
Fuck yeah. So back to the builds for a little bit. I'm still blown away by all this, the history stuff in Moab. I'm trying to focus. So what has been your most difficult build so far from a fabrication standpoint, not from like waiting on parts and a bunch of other admin shit?
They're all a little different, you know? So every time you're doing something custom and unique, it always has its own challenges.
Right.
You know, I think the most intensive one never really got any coverage. So if you look at, if you go through my Instacrap or my my face smells, you can find pictures of this yellow JK with a Cherokee Chief front end.
Okay.
And there's only a handful of pictures, right? I bet you there's less than 100 pictures of that rig in the world. But that front end was so much more difficult than anyone I've ever done. Because I used steel, right? I used actual steel. I didn't use one of those fiberglass kits.
Right.
And a Cherokee Chief or a J20 or a Gladiator, any of those original iron, they're like 9 inches wider than a JK.
I'm looking at the picture right now. I found it from June of 2020, and it definitely looks like you had to narrow it quite a bit.
Oh, yeah, like that hood, just the hood. Once it was all kind of cut apart and jigsawed together, that hood was like 16 individual pieces of steel.
Holy
that I had to,
shit.
Because I had to narrow it without it looking dumb.
Right.
So I had to narrow it. I also had to lengthen it. So I added like 2 1/16 inch to the back of it. But I had to do that with the JK hood. So I had to graft a JK hood into it.
Right.
And then reshape it so that it would attach to a JK properly. And then the fenders, like the wheel opening, the bottom of the wheel opening of that fender moved up like 6.5 inches.
Oh, geez.
To give it essentially a highline kit. And I had to fabricate even those fender flares. They're black in the picture. Those are steel.
No shit. So I thought they were just covered with something.
No, those are hand-fabbed steel that bolt on and off.
Holy shit.
And then the bumper was the easiest part. So I took a 1967 bumper and then just capped the top and narrowed it and built a hidden winch for it. But the bumper was the easiest part of that whole build.
Oh, shit, there is a winch in that bumper.
Yeah.
Sneaky. Yeah.
And then the grill, because I had to narrow the grill without it looking stupid, too. I think that grill was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 pieces. So I cut it into 8 pieces, narrowed it, and welded it all back together.
Jeez.
So that one, the fabrication time and the effort that one took to make it look natural,
right,
was just an enormous amount of work.
Now, was that a customer build or was that a build for a shop?
No, that was essentially a customer. So it was a company called Bavarian who makes, they actually make some really, really good wheels. They're a German company and they're based out of Germany.
Okay.
So they have to do an enormous amount of development on any product that they manufacture. So like their wheels are actually really, really good wheels. And they're not that expensive, but I built that for them, and then the vehicle was only together for like 2 days, and then we debuted it at the off-road expo, the Unlimited Off-Road Expo in Louisville, Kentucky.
Okay.
And at the end of the expo, we unbolted that front end and put it in a box, and they shipped it to Germany. And then they bolted it on another JK in Germany, so that they could 3D scan it because they were going to produce it.
Right.
And then they just decided not to do it. you know, because you gotta realize when you're building dies for that, you're talking like $500,000. So,
my goodness,
they just scrapped the project, and then the front end eventually got shipped back to the U.S. To California and was put back on the yellow Jeep. And their head marketing guy drove it around for like a year. And then they took it off and bolted on a factory front end, sold the Jeep. And it's that front end's literally sitting on a pallet rack in California, just collecting dust.
That can be bolted to the front of a JK.
Yeah, it takes like 25 to 35 minutes to bolt that onto the front of a JK.
And it's just sitting in a box somewhere.
It's sitting on a shelf in California.
Oh, and that has been painful.
For like a couple of years.
That is painful. Yep. That
but I think that one was the most difficult to blend properly. Because like the fiberglass one, you know, somebody did a fiberglass front clip that kind of looks, you know, similar. I think that fiberglass one that you can bolt on, I think it's just a big pile of junk. I don't like it. I think it looks, you know, it looks too pinched in. It doesn't fit the body lines right. And then Chris Durham built a really cool one. So he does one that's also fiberglass that attaches to your JK, but it's definitely wider and looks better. But he doesn't really market it. But Chris Durham is a phenomenal fabricator and builder, and off-roader and just an all around good dude. But Chris Durham makes a front end that you can turn your JK into something similar to that, but it's all fiberglass.
Okay.
That one, that yellow one is 100% all steel.
That is so badass. So it looks so good, man.
I don't, you know, like I would have rather done, I think on that Jeep, it would have been cooler. They started with the yellow Jeep, so they wanted the front end yellow because they didn't want to pay the extra couple grand to recolor the car.
Right.
But I think that would have looked really cool in like a 70s, you know, like khaki brown.
Oh,
or
shit, yeah.
You know, some old earth tone color, I think, would have been so much better than that ugly yellow.
Yeah, it's not the most beautiful yellow.
Right.
So my next question would be for the Jeep that you did for Quadratec, which I absolutely love because you put square headlights in a JL, which made so many people cry. It was fantastic. And I remember you and I talked, it was while you were still building it when it was still hush hush. And I haven't been that excited to see a build in a while at this point. So who did Quadratec come to you and they're like, hey, we want to make everyone cry. Please build this for us.
Yeah, basically they said, so Quadratec, a good friend at Quadratec, because I'm friends with a lot of guys there, a good buddy at Quadratec called and he's like, look, we want to do, you know, we've never done a true build before, like a Quadratec build.
Right.
He's like, you know, every year they do a build and they do giveaways and this, but, you know, usually it's a company solicits it and blah, blah, blah. So they wanted an actual Quadratec build. And I was like, cool. I said, what are you thinking? And he said, well, you know, and I don't remember the exact words, but he's like, you're the king of retro. and I was like, okay. And he says, Quadratec was started in 1989, you know, 1990. And it's their 30th year anniversary. And I was like, okay. And in my head, I'm like, he's going to say YJ. And the next thing out of his mouth was, Ted Wentz, the guy that started Quadratec, the whole reason that Quadratec was started was Ted Wentz, who was this race car dude.
Uh-huh.
He bought a 1989 Sahara YJ, and he was trying to find a new top for it. He wanted a soft top, and he was trying to find a good one. And all the avenues out there weren't good avenues, right? You could go in JC Whitney, or you could get a hold of Jeep, or you could do this, but there wasn't one place where you could kind of like see them all and figure out what you really wanted.
Right.
So he literally started Quadratec based on the need of wanting a top for his 1989 YJ. So, and he still has that YJ and it still looks like it just came off the showroom floor.
Really?
Yep. So, like, if you look at the cover of the Quadratec magazine where the YJL is, And most people don't even notice it, but in the bottom right of that cover is a photograph of the actual YJ that started Quadratec, because they still have it. So that's why, like, when you got to see, because you got to see stuff other people didn't, but, you know, you saw when I was working on the Jeep, it was a bone stock 2020 JL, and it was black.
Right.
And then when it finally hit the world, it's this beautiful tan. Well, that's the paint cone we used was the actual Sahara tan from 1989.
I love that. That's got to be my favorite color for a YJ. That the whole mm-hmm. the Sahara motif, if you will.
Right. So that was the thing, is he's like, you know, Ted still has his YJ. We want to take, he's like, do you think you can do the blend properly to make a JL kind of look like a YJ? And he's like, you know, we saw the Steer Smarts Gladiator you did, so we know you can kind of do it, but, you know, would you be willing to do it? And I was like, yep.
You're like, that's right up my alley.
So, and then my first thing was, I want full creative freedom. And originally I was told yes. That changed later, and they put some creative touches into it, which I wouldn't have done, but, you know, it's their car, so I had to allow it,
right?
Because they signed the paycheck,
right?
But but yeah, that was kind of the premise of it. So then, you know, it went normal, right? So Quadratec is a corporation, even though it's still owned by the same guy and it's still a family business. You know, so I had to submit a proposal, and I had to, you know, tell them, give them a base estimate of what I thought it might cost to do it. And so I did, you know, I gave them that information, and I did a rendering. I used to do all my own renderings myself, but they take me forever because I don't draw every day. Right.
Right.
When I was a kid, I did, but not anymore. So what I do now is, I've got this dude who is probably one of the best illustrators I've ever met in my life. Right. So he's not a graphic artist. He's an actual illustrator. Right. He draws the shit.
Right.
So, and there's a lot of people don't know this, but there's a huge difference between a graphic artist and an illustrator. But I've got this local dude who is just badass. His name's Alan Close, and he owns a company called APOC Design. And we met years ago, and we actually met right after I did Pathkiller. But he's just so cool, because when I call him and I'll pitch this idea, I'll be like, hey, this is what I'm thinking. And he gets it, right? So
I love his work. Love.
I can talk to him for like 15 minutes and spew the ideas that are in my head, and he'll put pen to paper and he'll do this rough sketch for me, and he sends me the rough sketch. And I would say 95% of the time when he's done with the rough sketch, I only will change a couple little tiny things. I'll be like, okay, well, you need to tweak this and you need to tweak that. And 5 minutes later, I have, you know, the rough sketch of what I'm thinking in my head. And then I'm like, all right, let's throw color to it and do this and this. And he's just so badass. Just an amazing dude, an amazing illustrator. And I'm really fortunate that I got to meet him and then got to introduce him to a lot of people. So I brought him to Moab, two Moabs in a row now.
Uh-huh.
So I brought him to 2019 EJS and introduced him to a lot of dudes. And then I brought him again this year, and he helped. He was basically my right-hand man doing the show at, you know, the vendor show at Dixie.
Right.
But I've also, you know, introduced him to a lot of people. You know, I introduced him to Kenny Hawk, and he's done some stuff for Kenny, and I introduced him to, you know, I've introduced him to Ian, and I've introduced him to Marvin Stammel and, mm-hmm. you know, Flex Rocks and Rollovers, yeah. And, you know, just a lot of different people. And he's taken off like gangbusters, you know, and I almost feel bad
that
I
love it.
I almost feel bad that I introduced him to so many people, because when I call him now and I'm like, you know, it used to be when I call him, right, in my head, it's a fire, right? I've got to get a rendering knocked out or a picture knocked out for somebody, and I need to show it to him tomorrow.
Right.
And, you know, 2 years ago when I called him, and I'd be like, all right, this is the idea, blah, blah, blah. And within an hour, I'd have a rough sketch. And now when I call him, he's like, well, let me see if I can fit you in 3 weeks. And I'm like, motherfucker. But, you know, either way, Alan is just a stand-up dude and so wicked. In fact, you and I talked about him the other day.
We did.
Because I got a present in the mail that came from Sean Wood, who is Tom Wood's drive shafts, right? So Sean Wood is Tom's son, and Sean is just an epic person. And Sean had a piece of art done from Alan, because I introduced them. And he had a piece of art done for a t-shirt, which shows this, you know, drive shaft, and it's kind of like a Santa Cruz style. And so Sean stepped up a few weeks ago and had 40 skateboards made that have this artwork on it. And they're just gorgeous. And Sean sent me a text message, and he's like, do you want an old school or a new school board? And I was like, well, I want old school, because, you know, I'm 40. So, you know, I want old shit. And he did. He sent me this awesome skateboard, which you can find on my social media on Unofficial Use Only. I posted some pictures of it, and it's like one of my new prized possessions. And then you made a comment on my post.
I did.
And shortly after you made a comment on my post, Tom Woods reached out to you about a skateboard, I heard.
Yes, my little notifications went off, and I was like, why the fuck is Tom Woods sending me a direct message?
Yeah, so absolutely epic. You know, I wanted to put chucks on it, and I wanted to skate around the shop with it and try not to kill my weebly wobbly 43-year-old fat ass. But then when I talked to Sean and he told me that there's only 40 of these in the world, I don't know if I can do that. I think I might just need to have Alan sign it and hang it on the wall.
Yes, absolutely.
But I'm enough of a lunatic where I might actually put chucks on it anyway and hang it on the wall that way.
That I can deal with.
But I am, and I'm very fortunate that I have this ability. Next time Alan comes over, I am going to make Alan sign this. And then next time I see Sean, whether it be EJS or any other trip out there, or maybe even SEMA, I'm going to bring this board, and I want Sean to sign it as well, because I want my board signed by all the people that had a hand in it.
Hell yeah, that would be sick.
Because then it's better than your board.
That's true. And I have mine sitting in the box. I pulled it in today. It got delivered today. And I'm going to do an unboxing later. But I have one of these 40 boards, and I'm freaking out.
Now, be very careful, because I don't know if this happened to everybody. You know, all of the 40 or, you know, the 20 that have been sent out, or however many there are, because I haven't asked Sean. But when I opened mine and I pulled the board out, I took the box and threw it towards the garbage can. And then my son, like an hour later, went to smush the box down into the trash can and found that there was also a matching t-shirt in the box.
Oh, shit.
So when you do your unboxing, just make sure you double check to see if you got, you know, anything else. And I don't know if he puts him in everyone. Maybe I'm special, maybe I'm not, but it's definitely worth checking to make sure you don't throw away a priceless t-shirt as well.
Absolutely. I will definitely have to do that.
If you didn't get one, then ha ha ha.
Well, I ordered one just to be safe.
Oh.
Yeah,
well,
with that design on it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But so. I'm definitely, I called you, and I was like, because I assumed that you had talked to them and be like, hey, send Angel aboard, but you're like, I didn't say shit.
Nope, I didn't. I have I've mentioned your name before, and I had that conversation with you, but I did not specifically call Sean and say, you should send one to Angel. Because if I would have done that, what I would have done is I would have said, Sean, can I buy one so that you can send it to Angel?
Very true.
But I had no part in that. I think it was just my rough guess is, you know, your name's probably been brought up before and you're badass. And somebody trolling social media noticed that and you got a board out of it. I will say that I do know that Sean is very, very hands-on with all of their social media. So the dude that reached out to you, there's, in my personal mind, there's a 99% chance that it wasn't just a dude that reached out to you. It was the owner of Tom Woods that reached out to you.
That was a nice little ego stroke for me. I'm not going to lie.
Well, good. Anytime I can offer you a stroke, that's good.
I had to go in the mirror and take my shirt off and look at myself and remind myself that I'm not shit to like bring my head back down to normal level.
Oh, dude, I'm getting closer and closer. I'm Austin Powers, you know, get in my belly.
Exactly. So what I'd like to do right now, do you have a couple more minutes for me? I know we've been going for a while.
Yeah, what do you got?
So what I want to do is I want to cut the podcast off here, and we're going to switch over to the subscriber podcast, where I have a couple more things that I want to talk about.
Okay.
So, ladies and gentlemen, for those of you listening to the regular podcast, thank you so much. Greg Henderson, thank you, dude. This has been incredible. Make sure you go check him out on his social media. Unofficial use only. Is there anywhere else they can find you?
Yeah, just unofficial use only. You can Google it. You can Google Greg Henderson and Jeep. You can Google unofficial use only. You can check out my Instagram, my Facebook, and I do have a YouTube. I don't populate it like I should because I'm too busy doing stuff.
Exactly.
But I do have, I think I only need like 21 more subscribers. So I hit that mythical 1,000 mark.
You heard him, guys. Let's get it done.
And when I hit that 1,000 mark, and I was going to make this video, and I do short and sweet videos because I suck. But when I hit the 1,000 mark, I'm going to give away something.
Uh-huh.
And then I think I'm going to start doing some really wicked giveaways on my YouTube for the next few months because I have thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars of stuff that I have used on builds that's taking up space on my shelf.
Right.
Like I have winches to give away and I have KC light bars and, you know, all these different lights and all this other stuff that I need to start giving away to get it off my shelf. And I figured that YouTube would be kind of a cool spot to do it.
Absolutely. You heard him, guys. Go subscribe. And then you and I can talk offline about you filming and I'll do some editing for you so you can get these videos out faster. But
yeah. And also for everybody listening right now, if we're going to jump over to a subscriber based podcast, if you are listening and you're not subscribed, what's the holdup? Step up your game.
It's only $3 a month. Come on. You spend more on that in monsters.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you. We're going to end it here and catch us on the subscriber side.